Hi, this is David Orlovsky, and welcome to the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Whether you're watching with our friends over at Torah Anytime, or wherever you watch or listen to your podcast, as always, it's wonderful to have you along. And we have a sponsor for this episode, anonymously. Thank you. And in honor of the greatest magic shear. You know, it's interesting. I'm going to be talking about my parents. And my mother, for my 12th birthday, got me my first magic set. That's how I started becoming a magician. And it comes with a certain limited number of tricks. And after a while, people were bored, so I had to go and get more tricks. And that's how I became a magician. And I wasn't that good at it. That's why I never pursued it. But you know that trick where you saw a woman in half? So I have two half-sisters. Anyway, that's a magician joke. A bunch of magician jokes. Notice that my fingers never leave my hands. That's a magician joke. Or my brother was also good with his hands. He gets out in 5 years. So these are standard magician jokes. They say the hand is faster than the eye. That's why there are so many black eyes. Anyway, these are all terrible magician jokes. Anyway, so thank you so much for the sponsorship. I'm in an interesting spot right now when this podcast comes out. I just had my father's yard site, and I'm about to have my mother's yard site. And they died 20 years and 6 days apart, the same week. Usually it's just enough that I can't get in one Shabbos beforehand, and each gets their own Shabbos, but it's like one right after another, so that people really get sick of me. As the old joke goes, his father made him an orphan, but he didn't make him a chazan. I wouldn't go so far as to make fun of my musical talents, but certainly people ask me to speak much more often than they ask me to sing. And a number of my children who are quite musical, so one of them said to me, you know, Abba, you're very good with the tune, you know, not necessarily the harmonies. So I always try to stick to the tune then, if that's the case. But in any event, so I'm right in between my mother and my father's yard site. And it's, of course, Parshas Yisro. And in Parshas Yisro, we have the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, that Hashem commanded us to honor your mother and your father. Kabed es avicha v'es imecha. Now, there's a reference in the Aseres Hadibros to the fact that we're already familiar with this. Because in last week's parsha, when they were at Mora, it says they gave them ktsas parshios. They gave them some parshios to learn. And what did they give them? So the Gemara says there were four things they gave them. Parah Aduma, Shabbos, Mishpatim, which is civil law, and Kibud Av V'Em. And when Rashi says it over, he leaves out Kibud Av V'Em. He mentions the other three. So the Maharal explains how to look at these mitzvahs. Now, you know, there's different ways to look at mitzvahs. What does the Chacham say at the Seder? Maha Edus v'hachukim v'hamishpatim. So you see, he divides the mitzvahs into three groups. A chok, people usually translate this as a law that makes no sense, but that's not really true, because you see, in the Sefer HaChinuch and the Rambam, they all give reasons for the mitzvahs. So to say it doesn't make any sense is not fair. Rather, it's a law you would not have thought up on your own. A mishpat is a law that you would have thought up on your own. Yeah, societies can come up with don't kill and don't steal, but they wouldn't necessarily come up with don't eat pig and don't wear shotness. Not that there's no reason for it, but they wouldn't have come up with that law on their own. They wouldn't have thought of it on their own. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to teach it. Of course, even our mishpatim are not just mishpatim. as the pasuk says, "V'lo asa chen l'ko goy umishpatim ba'yidaum." Yeah, our mishpatim we didn't make known to the regular world. We have a different way of looking at law than other societies do, and there are exceptions, different laws that apply, and things that come in. The fact that if you steal a cow and shecht it, you have to pay back 5 cows. And if you steal a sheep and shecht it, you have to pay back 4 sheep. That's not something that a normal society would come up with. Yeah. So even our mishpatim are different. But mishpatim are things that are considered more or less civil law that people would have thought up. So you have a chayk and you have a mishpat, and an edus is a mitzvah that is there to testify. So Shabbos is clearly an edus. Yeah, it's testifying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. And that's why when we say Vayechulu, it's two people saying it together, standing up, because they're giving edus. It's a testimony that Hashem created the world. The fact that you have a 7-day week is testimony that Hashem created the world. There's no reason to make a week of 7 days. I understand a month is how long it takes the moon to go around the earth. I understand a year is how long it takes the earth to go around the sun. I understand a day is how long it takes the earth to revolve on its axis. But there's no reason for a 7-day week. In fact, Napoleon Bonaparte, who was in a standardization mode, he wanted to make all of the measurements standard based on base 10. And that's why he came up with the metric system. You know, and 100 these equal 100 these equal 100 these. And that's how everything goes. You know, 1,000 grams makes a kilogram. You know, and 1,000 kilograms makes a metric ton. So things like that. He wanted to do the same thing with time. He wanted to make a 10-month year and a 10-day week. Didn't catch on, you know, but that's what he was trying to do, is to standardize everything, metric thing. But if you have a 7-day week, it's because you understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And that's how we have a week. Shabbos is an Eidus. And Paraduma is, of course, the ultimate chayk. And it's in Parshas Chukas for exactly that reason. It's a chayk. It's something that one struggles to understand. And Dinin, which is Mishpatim, that's all the laws that go in. That's one way of looking at it. There's another way of looking at it. This is what the Maharal says. And that is depth and breath means what? Shabbos has a lot of halachas, right? When you come to Shas, Shabbos has its own mesechta, and Erevin is basically also a Shabbos mesechta, and almost every mesechta has some Shabbos sugyas in it, and it pops up all over the place. There's a lot of laws of Shabbos, as we all know. There's a lot of halachas that are associated with it and how it goes and what you're supposed to do, and that's complicated. So that gives you the breadth of Torah. Dinin is all the depth of Torah. It's the svara. It's the understanding. The Gemara says if you want to become smart, you want to sharpen your mind, learn Noshim Nezikin. It doesn't say kudshim. Today, a lot of yeshivas, they like to do kudshim because the briskas did kudshim and everybody wants to pretend that they're brisk. So, you know, all these different... I had a couple of guys from one of these brisk yeshivas at my house for Shabbos, and it was pretty cold. They were walking home. And I said, "This is good weather for you." They said, "Why?" I said, "It's brisk." You get it? Anyway... Unfortunately, my tea is not Lipton, which is brisk. Yeah, brisk tea. But anyway, so it's the depth of learning. Depth. So one teaches you the breadth of Torah, and one teaches you the depth of Torah. And Paraduma teaches you the concept of the secrets of Torah. It is a esoteric area of Torah that is not based on how many laws there are, how deep it is. It's just secrets. It's secrets. And you understand that Torah has a different level to it. Somebody asked Rav Moshe Shapiro, how do you instill emunah in people today? And he said, Kabbalah. He says, when you show them the secrets of Torah, the depth of Torah, it has this power to really inspire people with a sense of emunah, because they understand that this is just not normal. There's something very, very special here going on. So that's the three categories. So why did Rashi leave out Kibud Av V'Em? He says Kibud Av V'Em is a different category. He says it's what he calls a mitzvah tivis. What does that mean, a natural mitzvah? It means that if there was a mitzvah to breathe, you wouldn't really have to learn that one, because that just comes naturally. You know that's part of your nature. And he says, Kibud Av V'Em is a mitzvah tivis. People want to be mechabed their parents. That's what he says. And it's a mitzvah that, listen to what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that this man overheard his wife talking to his daughter, who was being promiscuous. And she says to her, you should be more discreet. Look, I have seven sons, and only one of them is from your father. Now, they didn't have DNA testing back then. So when he died, he left his entire estate to my one true son. So how do you know? So they go to the Beis Din. He tells them, your father will answer you. Go down to his grave with sticks and bang on the grave until he gives you an answer. Okay? So they're banging. They're not getting any answer, and they come back. He says, I don't understand. You went to the grave? He says, yeah. With sticks? Yeah. And you beat on the grave? Yeah. Everybody? He says, no, not Yankel. He didn't think it was covered. He says, that's the real son. He had no way of knowing any more than the rest of you. But somehow on the inside, he understood that you mechabed your father. It was part of the etzem metzias of a person. So for that, you don't have to tell anybody. That's something that a person should have as a natural thing. Now, when we talked about Shalashudas, we mentioned how if you eat Shalashudas, you're protected for Gog and Magog. And what's Gog and Magog? Yeah. So the Gemara and Brachas that we quoted at the time said that the kapitel Tehillim, chapter of Tehillim that talks about of Shalom, is right next to the one that talks about Gog and Magog. Why? Because in case you say Gog and Magog, all the nations of the world are going to go up against God, that'll never happen. I'll show you that a son will turn against his father. So I heard from Rav Moshe Shapiro, says, it's the Maharal says the mitzvah tivis to want to honor your parents. And the fact that today we find children rebelling against their parents. Now understand, in Europe during the Haskalah, people rebelled, but it wasn't against their parents, it was against Judaism. I still remember a generation where the parents were from, and the kids weren't, and they would drive to the old neighborhood on Shabbos, park a block away, put on a yarmulke, and drop in on their parents. I was in the neighborhood. They had that much respect. It wasn't about their parents. They used to say about the mafia people, you know, there might be a hitman like this, but he was good to his mother. good to his mother. Harry Houdini's father was a Rav, Orthodox Rav in Wisconsin. He obviously went off and married a Shiksa Bess. But he was always mechabed his mother. And the fact that he got involved in the spiritualist movement is because he was desperate to get in contact with his mother. And he went to one of these people and this like ghost appears and starts talking to him. And he says, "That's impossible. My mother only spoke Yiddish." So Harry Houdini, whose real name was Eric Weiss, by the way, you know, he was always mechabed his mother. And this was normal. Pa, you know, people would, you know, my father had a lot of issues with his father, but he was always mechabed him and always took care of him and used to tell us, you know, you honor your grandfather. We saw it from my father. Today, I don't have to tell you. You know, parents tell kids things and they say, no, I'm not gonna. And people in my generation were like, didn't you get the memo? Like, I am the parent and I tell you what to do and you do it because that's how it works. That's how it's worked for thousands of years, but not in this door. Says Reb Moshe, that's the raya that we're in Gog and Magog. Because the raya of Gog and Magog is children turning against their parents for no reason. People turned against religion, but they didn't turn against their parents. And the fact that we see that going on, that's the raya. And so when I teach Masilas Yesharim, and I come to the point where it says you have to love Hashem like a child loves his father, they don't know what I'm talking about. I had kids who said to me, I don't owe my parents anything. They decide to have me. They owe me. I don't owe them a thing. Yikes. So here I am in between my father's yard site and my mother's yard site. And if I could live my life over again, I would definitely do it differently on a lot of different levels. One is I would have bought Amazon as soon as it came out. But okay, that's water under the bridge, as Ted Kennedy likes to say. But the fact that I could have been a much better son to my parents, no question about it. I wasn't appreciative. They gave me life. They took care of me. You know, were they perfect? No. There are no perfect people. Did they make mistakes? Sure. I had a guy who said to me once, am I mechuyev in kivud aveim if my parents are rishoyim? I said, didn't they pay tuition to send you to a yeshiva day school? And you think they're rishoyim? You don't know what a rasha is. We can't even imagine such a thing today. But where's your appreciation? Where's your hakaras hatov? This is a big problem. And you know, Adam Arishon, the first thing that he did wrong, it was a kafoy tov. He says, oh, the woman that you gave me, that's why this happened. He says, that's how you react. The fact that I gave you a wife, I made you a soulmate. The lack of appreciation, the lack of hakaras hatov, and the fact that people today don't want to be mechabed their parents. That's a sign that that we are mamish in serious trouble. This is Gog and Magog. This is the end of time. It means we're not people anymore. You understand? The part of the human experience. And that's where you find a mitzvah of kivud aveim in a very strange place. Chase away the mother bird before you take the babies. Because even an animal understands, you know, and parents care about them. It's something that's tivi, it's something that's natural to us. So I look back that lost my parents now so many years ago. And Remember, I lost my mother, and it suddenly hit me. I'm a yosem, which you don't appreciate until, like, Yontif comes around and you want to call your parents, say hello, and nobody there. Okay, so you're going to find other ways. But I felt like it is so important, especially Parshas Yisro, I'm in between two yard sites, to speak about the Hakaras HaTov that we owe our parents. My father, his father came from Węgrów, Poland, never learned English, worked in the garment business. And the way my father tells it, he was not that concerned about providing for his family. He bought himself nice clothes. My grandmother had to hide money in order to buy milk for the children. There was nothing there. It was he liked to play pinochle, and he wasn't particularly good at it, apparently. And my father knew real hunger. He dropped out of school after eighth grade to go to work to help support the family because, you know, my grandfather wasn't doing it, you know. And he would always describe his mother as a saint, you know, who did everything. In fact, it was very interesting because my grandfather wanted to marry my grandmother because her family owned a dress factory, and he figured he'd get an easy job. But she only wanted to marry a Talmid Chacham. And my grandfather was many things, but he was not a Talmid Chacham. But he had a brother, Yaakov, who was a Talmid Chacham. And he had him write letters to her, and he signed his name with Divrei Torah and things. And she thought, wow, this guy's Talmid Chacham. And you can only imagine the surprise when she married him. Orlovskys have not really changed in thousands of years. Anyway, but she was, I mean, you know, the children loved her like, you know, the Dubna family. And I have the schus of being in touch with some of the Dubnas to this day. And, you know, they came from Vishkovov. They were, you know, very classy family. And Baruch Hashem, you know, they were from family. But like I say, if you wanted to work back then, yeah, I worked Shabbos. My father worked Shabbos. And he had no Jewish education. My grandfather didn't get him any Jewish education. Whatever he grew up with, he remembers. He remembered in Brownsville, you know, carrying the cholent home from the baker. You know, everybody would put their cholent in the baker's oven and you'd carry home your cholent for Shabbos, you know. He remembers that. He remembers singing in the choir with the great Chazonim who would come to Brownsville, you know, for Shabbos to, I would say daven, but probably to perform. My father was in the choir, and his uncle and his brother Bernie, they would sing. And my father had a Chazonish voice, and he'd love to sing Chazonis. And he would love to play Chazonish records for me. I think if I go to heaven, it'll be because of that I sat there and listened to his Chazonis records, which to this day I hear Chazonis and I want to just eat my arm. Chew it off. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. So he had one goal in life, and he wasn't Shomer Shabbos. He wanted to marry a Jewish girl and bring his children up to be Jewish. Not from, Jewish. That was that generation. My mother came from a much more assimilated family, and it's kind of ironic. Her mother was the daughter of a big Rav in Vilna. Rudnitsky, Avram Fishel Rudnitsky. He was written up, and he was it's a big time of Chacham. And when the pogrom started, he sent his kids to America. My grandmother came to America. She was a teenager. She was on her own, And she married a fellow from Odessa who my mother says did not go to shul on Yom Kippur. That's how similar he was. But he was a hardworking fellow. He bought himself a bus. And there were no city bus lines back then. All the bus lines were private. And you would drive around and make your own route. And he got another bus and another bus. And he built it into a bus line. And it turned into a company. And then he brought his brothers over from Europe and put them into the business. And so my mother grew up in, at the time, Laurelton was considered a fancy neighborhood. And they were much more well off. My father was dirt poor. My mother came from a comfortable family. She went to art school. She was, you know. My grandfather died when she was a teenager. And his bus lines turned into the Green Line Bus Company in Queens. And when he died, it was suddenly pneumonia. They didn't have antibiotics yet. His brothers all squeezed my grandmother out of the company. For years, whenever I would go to Queens and I'd see a Green Line bus, I'd say, that's my bus. I should have had a bus company. Instead of a rabbi, I could have been a balabus. But, you know, they things got a little strapped, but she still had some stock or whatever they were managing. But it was she grew up in a house with very little. And my father met my mother, and they got married. And my father said, I'm going to have a Jewish home. So my mother didn't know exactly what that meant, but she was like, sure, go along, whatever my father wants. My parents were married almost 50 years, and they were always in love. Now, that generation, they had a good expression. They used to holler. They didn't yell. They hollered. What are you hollering? I'm not hollering. You're hollering. It's better than yelling. Today, people yell. Back then, they would holler, and they would argue, and they would fight, and they were crazy about each other. Except when my mother was in the hospital having a baby, my parents were never apart. They were always together. When my father was in the hospital, my mother was by his side the whole time. When my mother was in the hospital, my father went to work. Yeah, he'd visit her. But my father wanted a dozen kids. When my brother was born, Bruce was the sixth, he bought her a mink stole. He says, give me another six and I'll get you the whole coat. But it was unusual back then to have six kids. We were the talk of the town, you know. Six boys. It was very unusual. But my father wanted to have children and he wanted to provide for them. And he had a business and he worked to be able to provide. And then at some point he went bankrupt because he had a bad accountant. So he says, how could I be bankrupt? I work day and night. And he says, well, you have too many trucks. You have too many workers. He said, but that's your job as my accountant to keep track of the expenses. He goes, well, anyway, I took my last bill and you're on your own. And my father had to literally rebuild. And it was at that point that one of my brothers was considered too smart for public school. And the school sent him to a private school. Now, my father left school after eighth grade. He grew up in Brownsville. You know, well, what's a private school? It meant the yeshiva. So he looked up the local yeshiva, the Hebrew Academy of Nassau County, and he sent this brother. And Rabbi Findel convinced him to send the three younger boys. And we ended up in yeshiva. And my father didn't have the money for this. I said to my mother once, how did you manage? So I didn't buy a new dress. So we didn't go on vacation. We managed. It was a little less. I often talk about how in life, it's often one decision that makes all the difference in the world. And that's why when the Gemara says, kolas chalos koshos, all beginnings are hard. Yeah. So Tosfos says, that's what it means when it says, a psia gasa takes away 1/500th of the light of your eyes. He says, it's just the first step. because you could go on a 1,000-mile journey, but it begins with the first step. And that's why people make certain decisions in life. My parents, if they were alive, would now have 100 great-grandchildren. All of them being brought up in Torah mitzvahs. You look at other branches of the family, there's nothing left. Because they took that one step, that one psiagasa. They said, I'm going to sacrifice and get my kids a Jewish education. It changed everything. And so all the things that I do in life, it's all in the schus of my father and my mother and the sacrifices that they made. Yeah. I would think to myself, you know, I was speaking about myself. I was such an ingrate. I didn't appreciate what my parents did for me. My father had all these children and worked hard to support them and to take care of them, send them to school, pay tuitions. You know, my father would help when it came to buying a house, and he would always say, my greatest pride is that all my children have houses that they can live in, that they can afford a house. You know, it was amazing. Well, as he got older, like all people of a certain age, they lose contact with reality, you know. My mother would send me shopping. I used to do the shopping. You know, I'd come back and says, tuna fish? What are you talking about? They're five for a dollar. My mother would be like, no, not for 40 years, Dad. You know, the price has changed. And they were very makbid that my mother, don't talk to your father that way. My father, don't talk to your mother that way. They were mechabed their parents. It was the kind of thing where there was a sense of covet. He always had a covered rabbanim. He became firm when he was 67 and, you know, spent his last years. But he always wanted to do it. It was such an interesting thing. At a certain point, he would go away to a firm hotel for Pesach. He went to the earliest minyanim. He went to every shir. He went, you know. There was one time I came in to give a class. And someone says to my mother, not knowing that's my mother, says, oh, isn't he wonderful? And she says, yes, he speaks very well, you know. She goes, I hear his parents aren't from. My mother says, you can never tell these days. You know? And it's such an interesting thing. I remember I said to my father once, I said, what are we, reform, conservative, what are we? He says, we're conservative. We went to a conservative synagogue when we went to shul. Yeah, we're conservative. I said, Dad, but conservative also says you have to keep Shabbos. He says, okay, we're reform. And I thought that was so interesting that labels really have no meaning. There are a lot of people who say they're Reform Jews. They don't know what Reform Judaism believes in. They don't know anything about it. You know, it's just, I know I'm not doing anything, so I must be Reform. But if I had to label my father what he was when I was growing up, he was a non-practicing Orthodox Jew. But all his hashkafas were Orthodox. I'll never forget one Rosh Hashanah, we were in the conservative synagogue. I was a little kid. And my father says to the rabbi, you know, I come Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I really should make more of an effort to come on Shabbos. It's so hard, you know, because Saturday is the biggest day in the flower business. And the rabbi says, look, Marty, you know, you give a lot of charity. You send your kids to yeshiva. You know, you do a lot of good things. And my father got angry. He says, you're the rabbi. You're supposed to tell me I'm doing the wrong thing. I know I'm doing the wrong thing. Don't try to convince me I'm doing the right thing. You know, black and white. There's right and there's wrong, you know? And that's why when I started becoming from a 12 and I started making changes, everything was a fight. But eventually, you know, there were certain kosher problems that I was aware of. They right away decided they would keep a kosher home because my father's father said he wouldn't eat in the house unless it was kosher. But I mean, they kept what they knew, you know? There were problems. So I started getting like my own pot and stuff, you know, because I was a little nervous, you know, about things. My parents were furious. And luckily, I wasn't home the night that my brother burnt down the kitchen because they were sure I was behind it. But a kid in my class, lost her father, and I got on my bicycle because my parents worked, you know. And I rode like 5 miles to go and pay a Shiva call, yeah. And I came back, and I see my brother, you know, scrubbing the soot off of the ceiling, and the whole kitchen burnt down. What happened? Because I was the token girl. We had 6 boys, and you know, when you have certain reptiles, if they're all males, some of them turn into females so that they can continue the species. So this happens also sometimes in families. So my mother worked, and I became the girl. I did the cooking, the cleaning, the shopping, and the laundry, those kind of things. Anyway, so my brother didn't know how to cook, so he wanted blintzes. So he took a frying pan, he filled it up to the top with oil, he turned it on high, and he went to watch the game. And at some point, he saw the whole house was filling with smoke. So, of course, he threw water on it, and the oil exploded all over, and the whole kitchen went up in flames. And my mother was sure I was behind it. I said, I wasn't here, you know? Why weren't you here? I said, I went to pay a Shiva call. I rode 5 miles on my bicycle to go and pay a Shiva call, get my clothes. But, you know, now I have some suggestions for changes. I think we should maybe have 2 sinks. I think maybe 2 dishwashers. Maybe that is what we call Lieben Gummer in Kashrus. Yeah, we use real Aish. And as things turned around, one by one, all of the brothers became frum. And my father would say, I'll pay for your kids to go to yeshiva. I want the children to go to yeshiva. I want them to be frum. And it's just absolutely amazing when you look at other lines of the family. Many of them have totally disappeared or certainly disappeared as Jews. And my parents have 100 great-grandchildren being brought up in Torah mitzvahs. This is a testimony to the decisions that they've made. My life has been a poor attempt to imitate the man. I'm just a living legacy to the leader of the band. That was Dan Fogelberg. Anyway, so it should be an aliyah for my parents, the Shabbos, all the good that they did in their lifetime. Continues to do it. Your side is a Yom HaDin, because we take a look and say, what did you do over this past year? What did I do? I was dead. Yeah, but look at your children, look at your grandchildren, look at your great-grandchildren, look at all the things that are taking place because of the decisions you made that you were alive, and they're still producing dividends. And it's Hashem. They should continue to be up in Shemayim as a Melech Yosha for us and the extended family and for the extended Klal Yisrael, because my father always cared about Klal Yisrael. He always cared. That was always the top of his list. Okay, and this brings us to the question and answer portion of the program. We have a sponsor, sponsored by the Klompas family. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Klompas, Klompas. For inspiring Klal Yisrael during these challenging times. Oh, wow. Thank you so much. You know, it's only because of nice people like you that we're able to do all this. First question is by CK. I thought you were canceled. How many questions are in the queue, and what percentage of them do you answer, and how do you choose? There's probably about 100 altogether, I'm guesstimating. 300? There are about 300, yikes, there are about 300 questions. How do I, closer to 400, there's closer to 400. I think if I keep waiting, they're going up even as we speak. Yeah, that's a lot. So, you know, sometimes I have a podcast where I just go too long, or I'm doing something else and we don't really have time for questions. So obviously the backlog, it just keeps coming, you know. If you ever remember that famous I Love Lucy, where she and Ethel go out to work at the candy factory, and you know, and the candies are coming by and they're trying to wrap them, and they're going faster and faster, and they just start eating them and sticking them in their pockets. And like, you know, so that's what we're doing with the questions. So how do I pick them? So I try to make a little bit of a mix where I take questions like this, which are just like, you know, what's your favorite this or what do you do? Just sort of personal questions or just questions about the show and things like that with, you know, deep hashkafa questions. So full disclosure, sometimes I get a question and I just don't know. As you remember, when someone said to me, we say Yud K, Vav K, why do we substitute the hey with K? You know, and we do that also in Elikim. But for example, we also say Shakai, the Dalet, you know. So I gave the best answer that I could. I call a few of my Talmud Chacham friends. Sometimes they know, sometimes they don't know. So sometimes I don't answer the question, just I have no idea, you know. Sometimes the questions are a little too involved or too specific. So I try to find questions that are going to be shovelical nefesh, that will be relevant and meaningful to everybody. So what I do is usually just before the show, I go through the list of questions and I pull up a few that just happen to tickle my fancy that particular day, and I put them in. And sometimes I look at a question and I feel like I've answered this one already, or at least in some form. And so I skip over those. So some people make the mistake of sending the question directly to me instead of to the question and answer on the website. And so I have a whole bunch of them in emails that I really have to forward to the producer so he can add them to the list. So if you wrote me personally and didn't get an answer, that's probably why. Sometimes I try to answer you back when I have the opportunity. Okay. And the next question is by Anonymous. How do you relate to your animated Torah Live character, Rabbi Sitter? You'd be surprised how many places I go and people know me as Rabbi Sitter. And sometimes the parent will say to a kid, this is Rabbi Sitter. And they look at me and they say, yeah, Rabbi Sitter, you know. So I put on my, hi, kids. How's it going? So nice to see you here today. Let's talk about Amuna, whatever it is. Now, I'll tell you the truth. I've thought for many years, years and years and years, that I was always meant to be a cartoon character. Because in real life, I'm also something of a cartoon character. There's something about me where, you know, certain people just have trouble taking me seriously. And that works to my advantage because there was one time when I was giving a shiur, you know, and someone says they went to some really stark Rebbetzin. She says, how does he get away with saying things like this? If I would say that, and I'm pretty frump, if I would say that, I would get killed, you know, because it's so stark. So the person asked me, and I said, because I'm funny. When you're funny, you can say anything you want, because then people are like, he's probably joking. No, I'm not. My Rebbe, Rebbe Yaakov Weil, was the fanatic of the school, and I basically say over his things, only I try to say it a little funnier so I can get away with it and get out of trouble, you know? So so it does give you a certain advantage. But I don't know if you've noticed this, but they drew Rabbi Sitter to look a little bit like me. My hair is not that white, and I don't think my nose is quite that long, but it does have a certain Rabbi Orlovsky kind of a feel to it. In fact, Torah Live is in the process of making Rabbi Sitter plush dolls that are going to be available for sale. So I'm sure every little kid would want to cozy up with a Rabbi Sitter doll before they go to sleep, you know. But I will tell you this. I haven't seen a lot of my videos because I don't know how to access the website. My grandchildren watch them all, but I don't really know how. But they sent me once a clip as an email attachment so I could watch it right away of my shiur on patience. Now, this is based on a shiur I've given many times. Most of the Rabbi Sitter videos is me sitting in a room in front of a microphone and just talking. And they animated it. And the animation takes everything I was saying to another level that I was nispoil from how incredible the message that I was giving, I felt, was so much more effective because of the animation. So Lahavdil, I saw an interview with J.R.R. Martin, who wrote a very popular fantasy series, Game of Thrones, which I, of course, I'm not going to read because it's got too much off-color material in it. But apparently there's this character there, Tyrion, who's supposed to be very clever and witty, you know. So they said, which of your characters do you relate to the most? And he says, Tyrion, I'm just not that fast. I just can't think up all the things that he says. So I look at Rabbi Sitter and I say, gee, you know, one part of me would love to be Rabbi Sitter. But it is only an alter ego. And it is the fact that I get to inspire children in this way, and sometimes adults who also enjoy it. A lot of it, I mean, like the Amuna series is just by classes on Masil Shasharim, you know, animated, you know, but it's basically just me and a lot of my normal material, and the animation just takes it into a new realm. So kudos to Torah Live. By the way, they have a brand new studio. I know they give tours certain times, you know, and have different things, and you could film yourself in a Rabbi Sitter video and things. So next time you're in Yerushalayim and you want to do something with the kids, you know, check out the Torah Live studios. By Anonymous, do you approve of yeshivas promoting competition between the boys to get them to learn better? Kinnas Seifrim. Kinnas Seifrim, the Gemara says, is a good thing to encourage people. One of the reasons we make a big party when you finish a siyum is so that other people will want to make a siyum. I am now in my third cycle of Daf Yomi. And the reason I got into it was because they finished the Daf Yomi and they asked me to come speak at a siyum. And I said, I don't feel comfortable. I don't learn Daf Yomi. And they said, no, nobody does. Nobody comes to speak. So I heard Rabbi Fran once say, siyum hashas, he says, when your friend is having a simcha, you participate. But I feel, I felt kind of hypocritical coming and praising Daf Yomi when I myself won't do it. So I said, okay, I'm going to do Daf Yomi. And so I'm in my third cycle now. And one of the things that definitely inspired me were all those, all the siyumim, all the big parties. You know, you go to the Meadowlands, tens of thousands of Yidden and dressed in black doing the wave. I mean, it's just something incredible. You know what I mean? Black wave. That never happened, by the way, full disclosure. But the good friend of mine who was doing the video, he included my Daf Yomi shir in the video. You could see it for about maybe a second. It's just, there I am. So that's why these things spur people on. And competitions help people to push themselves to try to be better. Now, an ideal competition is one which lets everybody accomplish something on their own level. I'll give you an example. When I was a Mashgiach in Odovit, we had a problem. And the problem was that we finished Seder at 1, and then there was lunch and free time, and 3 o'clock was Mincha. And people were not showing up at 3 o'clock. They were straggling in. So I sat down to try to solve this problem, and I said, I got an idea. I'm going to offer optional Mishnayos from 2:30 to 3. And anyone who comes, I will buy them one of those little paper Mishnayos. And after each Masechta, we'll have a little Siyum, you know, cake and soda. And if you finish the whole Seder Moed, I'll take you out to a restaurant. That's what I did. And I remember when my father was Nifter, so I started doing it as a schus for my father. And people would show up. And my ostensible reason for doing it was so that I'd have people there as a base for Mincha who are already there. And so it was a miftza, if you will. That not so much a competition, but they have in yeshivas, I know Rabbi Senta does this and other yeshivas do this, where like they do a trip to Poland, someplace in Eastern Europe, and they have certain things. If you make it to Minion this number of times, if you, you know, come in for extra stardom, if you come this, etc. There's a point system. You get points for everything. And then as many points as you have at the end, you can cash them in for cash for the trip. So you could get your whole trip paid for if you participate in everything. So that's not so much a competition as much as a, I guess the word is again, mifsa, an opportunity for people to earn points. But when you have a straightforward competition, like who's going to write the best of our Torah, I've seen people work very hard in order to try to be able to do it. Now, when I was building my chapter in Los Angeles of NCSY, we were a very small group. I think there were six kids. At the regional the year before, we couldn't even get our own table. We had to share it with another chapter. And I wanted to motivate people, so I decided to use competition. I came in the first day, and I said, we're going to be chapter of the year. And Joel Petlin, who is my president and my good friend, he says, no, we're not. We're never going to be chapter of the year. I said, yes, we are. We're going to make this program. We're going to make that program, you know. And we started pushing and all kinds of programming and stuff, and we would use the competition. And then we would go to a regional and we would be in everyone's face and we were unusually obnoxious. Now, I don't know why this is, but both my chapter in Los Angeles and my region in Long Island had a tendency to be unusually obnoxious to other people. And I don't know where this came from because I always told everyone to be warm and loving and caring. I guess I did. But anyway, so we'd go in there and we'd like, be very in everyone's face. And my kids loved the competition. They loved it. It pushed them on to do much more than they ever would. I had kids who came to Shabbatunim not because they wanted to, but because it would help us win chapter of the year. It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant, the competition, to be able to get it going. And when I took over Long Island, I right away started a whole bunch of chapters, even though you would say, why don't you combine these two? Because I wanted to make a competition and have them going after each other. And I felt that would be an impetus for people to do better. I remember the first national convention we went to, I had a bunch of punk rockers in my region who were coming. And they're supposed to do a regional song and a regional skit. And we didn't have any of those things, you know. And the kids were like, hey, we'll have a song. I said, I told you you have to make a song. Nobody was interested. So now you don't have a song. This one guy said, I wrote a song. Can we do it? I said, what's it to? Psycho Killer. Sure, go ahead. Now, Itchy Lowenbrown, Zatzal, a good friend of mine, he was Seaboard. They had like 50 kids up there. They were singing a song to like Hallelujah. We are Seaboard. We're the best. We learn Torah like all the rest. We love Torah and mitzvos. Seaboard region. We are going high, whatever it is, you know, that kind of thing like this. You know, la, la, la. It was great. My kids get up there. Dressed in denim. I remember this. This is 1980. I still remember it. Ba 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 da da ba 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 ba. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I find it hard to brace up to the facts. This here convention is getting me down. Prison wardens chasing me around town. Psycho Jew, who are you? Buck, 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 buck. And I was like, I never understood what the chicken was, but evidently they had already made a takeoff of Psycho Killer called Psycho Chicken. So they threw in the chicken. You're gonna run, run, run away. Ba, ba, ba. Anyway, the judges, it was the Shaliach, Yitzchak Bar Or, and two secretaries. And the secretaries were like horrified. And Yitzchak Bar Or says, I like it. We won most original song. But, competition's good. It gets people going, you know? So, I think it's a good idea. All right. I think we're out of time. And that's it for this episode. If you want to find out more about the show, go to my website, rabbialofty.com. You can sponsor an episode. You can sponsor a question and answer. You can sign up for an online share. You can hold the lettuce. Special orders don't upset us. All we ask is that you let us do it your way. And that's until next time. I am David Orlovsky, and this has been The Rabbi Orlovsky Show.
It's The Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Torah and Simcha, ready to go. The Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Knowledge and wisdom will help you grow. Lots of fun in every episode. And we don't have to rhyme. No, we don't. It's The Rabbi Orlovsky Show on RabbiOrlovsky.com. Torah, anytime, YouTube, and more. It's The Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Torah and Simcha, ready to go. It's The Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Till next time, till we meet again. It's The Rabbi Orlovsky Show. It's The Rabbi Orlovsky Show. It's The Rabbi Orlovsky Show.